Hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Tim, your stay last night at a desolate motel in the middle of nowhere, uneventful, right?
No, yeah, a lot happened, actually, yeah. Felt like somebody was watching me.
Oh, dear, we may have to get into that in a minute, and we will. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new, I don't know, what do you call it, genre-bending, fun action drama thing. Anyway, it's called Bad Times at the El Royale. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to look at some of the news from the past week, including Twilight. Can you believe the first Twilight movie is 10 years old?
I can't.
Yeah. I was going to say I can, but okay. We're going to talk about its legacy, and then we will ask Tim to tell us about his top five scary movies. But first, this is a name that was in the news earlier this summer, but has kind of faded, and but now it's back. We're talking about James Gunn, and I think Tim was on that episode when we were talking about when he was fired from Disney, from making Guardians of the Galaxy 3 because of some old tweets that were dug up. Mm-hmm. But it seems like everything's coming up James Gunn, because he is in talks to make the lateral move from Marvel to DC.
Oh, no. How dare he?
Well, I mean, a lot of people are excited that, you know, there's a possibility that he's looking at writing and even directing Suicide Squad 2. Which would be the sequel to Suicide Squad, which a lot of people took exception with as kind of a ripoff of Guardians of the Galaxy, even though they're both comic books that existed. But I guess it was the tone with, you know, characters who weren't necessarily heroic characters, mm-hmm. who were always like joking and sniping at each other, and of course the veritable soundtrack, different pop mm-hmm. songs and things. But I think we both agreed at the time that perhaps Disney was a bit hasty in firing James Gunn, or at least did not do the due diligence of, you know, maybe giving him, I don't know, a chance to explain himself or, mm-hmm. I don't know. But, you know, how do you feel? First of all, I want to know how you feel about Suicide Squad and whether or not maybe James Gunn will improve the chances you might be interested in seeing the sequel.
I think he'll improve it, given what he's done with Guardians of the Galaxy, and given
Suicide
Squad's coming from, right? So I think he has a good opportunity for that. I think it's tough in like social media world, right? I look back at the tweets like for this episode, I'm like, wow, I took offense to mainly all of them, and I could see when you just look at the text, you'd be like, oh. Need to get rid of this guy. But it's just like people do so many stupid things trying to be funny. Mm. And now we've lost the ability to do stupid things and try to be funny because you don't know what could happen or what the repercussions will be. And that's what happened to him, right? He was really distasteful in his what he put. But like I felt like in his apology on Twitter, he was contrite and he said, this is how I used to be. I've matured since then, and this mm-hmm. was me trying to be funny, and I wasn't, basically, right?
Right. So. Yeah, and he comes from trauma films, which, you know, if you want to talk about unoffensive, you probably don't want to put on something produced by Larry Kaufman, who's an interesting guy. Yeah. You know, it was there was such blowback about him being fired, and I think it comes from like people who are just like straight up fans of Guardians, mm-hmm. and like what he did with those characters who were basically like C-list, D-list characters, mm-hmm. and his voice on it was so big. Like I think he might have rewritten or done some writing on Avengers, at least for the Guardian scenes, mm-hmm. because that seems to just gel with the two main Guardians films so well, at least in terms of the dialogue and the characterization. But because the blowback against him being fired was so ferocious on the part of fans, anyone signing him up for anything after that, it was going to be like a coup. It was going to be mm-hmm. like, oh, wow, I can't believe that, you know, the so-and-so has signed him up to do this project. Mm-hmm. But what's completely fascinating is that it's for this project, the Suicide Squad project, because people were so, you know, angry at Suicide Squad for walking over the same ground. And now, and I saw somebody online say this, so, you know, there's like, well, everyone who like hated on Suicide Squad for being a Guardians ripoff now has to go and delete those tweets. Yeah.
And they should have the Suicide director direct Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Can you imagine if David Ayer signed on to make Guardians of the Galaxy 3?
That'd be funny. Yeah.
I kind of want it actually, but yeah. I think he's busy working on the Bright sequel.
Oh, really? Okay.
the enthusiasm. But yeah, the thing with the Suicide Squad, though, is that it's a fascinating situation because it's a movie that made $750 million worldwide that almost – you talk to anybody and almost everybody hates it, or anybody mm-hmm. who wants to talk about it talks about hating it. They wanted to get Mel Gibson on it for a while. And, of course, Mel Gibson has his lengthy history of issues.
And to now, actually direct it?
To write and direct it, yeah. Wow. This was after Hacksaw Ridge became an Oscar hit.
Okay.
But then, yeah, now we have James Gunn. So it's just like, who's the latest problematic person we could put on this? I don't know. Yeah. But I do think it needs, like, a strong direction because from my personal point of view, I like the casting on the Suicide Squad movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it had a great cast. Like Will Smith was great, Margot Robbie was great, Viola Davis was great, even Jai Courtney was pretty good in it. It looked good, but it was a complete mess. And of course, there was all this background about David Ayer not being in charge of the final edit, and they gave it to this trailer company, and there was all the fallout of Batman versus Superman, but.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a film that needs, or a project that has a lot of goodwill there to an extent, mm-hmm. but needs a strong voice in order to make it, to maybe realize it. And maybe that's where James Gunn comes in.
Yeah, he could be a strong voice and really make the humor that much better, because Guardians of the Galaxy is way funnier.
You know? Right.
Yeah, and, you know, hone it in. I find with a lot of superhero movies nowadays where they have huge casts of superheroes, it's like a half hour of introducing all the characters before anything happens, you know? Like, it's because there's so many characters and so many, like, side deals between the different, you know, whatever it is, DC, Marvel, Warner Brothers, so many side deals. And then it's just like by the time they get to any action, it's like it's lost its steam, you know?
Yeah. And Suicide Squad is very much like that.
Yeah. It was like, here's 20 minutes of just introducing the characters, right? Of course, that's the first one. So maybe in the second one, they'll just get more into the action.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. I just find it's kind of stilted in that way. So any humor, anything, you know, and live by the sword, die by the sword, you know, with him, right? Like, his off-kilter humor will help with the movie, just hopefully in his personal life and on social media he doesn't go back to
old habits. I think one thing I think we can say about it is that in terms of everybody who's sort of been Me Too'd, although it's questionable if James Gunn's count, he was like one of the most contrite, so he understands that, you know, what he did was wrong, and not that the stuff he did was anywhere near in the ballpark of someone like Harvey Weinstein, but, you know, he's someone that deserves a second chance. I think it's just the fact that it's this project, and mm-hmm. and given the relationship, it's bizarre. It's you know, it's a funny old world we live in.
It is, yeah. it's like in the sports world, like somebody it's caught with steroids, and they're like, oh, he's never going to play again, or domestic abuse, never going to play again, and then they end up on the field shortly afterwards. You know, it's like the entertainment world, right? Like you're saying about James Gunn,
mm-hmm.
you know, you look at the tweets, you're like, wow, that's pretty nasty, and if he wasn't as talented as he was as a writer-director, would people be you know, jumping on the bandwagon again for him. Probably not, but right. because he is, it's like, okay, yeah, we need this guy back, you know?
Yeah.
He's at the peak of his talents right now. We want to see what he'll do with Suicide Squad.
Mm.
Whereas from a strictly morality standpoint, you'd say no, mm. just based on what he's done in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. Well, speaking of stolid, it's a bit early, but Twilight turns 10 this year. And they had a sort of reunion at, or a reunion panel at New York Comic Con. It was Catherine Hardwicke and a couple of the minor stars, although Robert Pattinson did Skype in, mm-hmm. from what I understand, for a portion of the panel. But it's interesting that this movie franchise, and I don't know how, did you see any of the Twilights?
I haven't seen Twilight. I started to watch it just for research for the show, and I enjoyed it. I watched the first 20 minutes of it. I was like, where is this going? Is this like Mean Girls or something, like in the high school? And I was kind of enjoying it for the first 20 minutes. I don't know where it goes from there. So that's all I've seen of Twilight is first 20 minutes of the first one.
And
on
it had
Netflix.
You hooked. It had you hooked.
I was into it, yeah.
Yeah,
I can see the appeal for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've seen the first three movies, but I've read all four of the books. I think that Stephanie Meyer, when you read all the four of the books, you can sort of see her progress mm-hmm. as a writer, not necessarily in terms of the content, but just in terms of like the craft. Mm-hmm. Because if you read the first Twilight book, it's clear she has no understanding of rising action, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that the movie corrected somewhat. But it's fascinating to me that this movie, 10 years ago, the source of so much pandemonium on the one hand, mm-hmm. and utter and complete hatred on the other. Mm-hmm. And now we're sort of 10 years away from it, and at least maybe 4 or 5 years from when the last movie was released. And now it's, you know, it's kind of an NBD, yeah. No big deal.
Just loses its steam, right?
That's maybe.
Just, you know, it was a popular, don't want to call it a fad because it had such a following for a short period of time. But mm-hmm. as time passes, you know, you wait for the nostalgia factor to kick in, and it could be 20 years later. But yeah, right now, you know, it's just sort of died out a little bit because it's just not at the peak of its popularity right now.
And yeah.
Vampire movies in general, right, were very popular. And then it went to, you know, zombies and zombie shows. Now people are getting tired of those. So we'll go back to vampires now.
Like, you might be onto something there because this was something I wondered if we would talk about it this week. But The Walking Dead, the new season premiered 2 weeks ago. And like the audience was like, it was half of what it normally is.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is Walking Dead. You know, because it's on AMC basic cable, it doesn't get measured like other shows, but it's one mm-hmm. of the most popular shows on TV in terms of just the sheer number of people who watch. But mm-hmm. now it's, you know, it looks like maybe it's waning days for The Walking Dead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a big season too, because it's Andrew Lincoln's last season. We're getting off Twilight. But the point you make is valid, that maybe the zombies now are dying off and maybe we're coming back to vampires again. And maybe, you know, the 10 years of Twilight.
Yeah, the nostalgia factor might be kicking in now. The fact that this is a story, the 10th year anniversary.
Yeah.
And it sounded from the article like it's waned a little bit, but they're still diehard fans.
Oh, sure.
And they remember, when I was a 15-year-old girl, like 15-year-old boy, whatever, I was really into this. This was, you know, and it just brings back those feelings, right? It's just...
Yeah, the article is Slash Film. One of the correspondents for Slash Film was at the New York Comic Con. And she said she was 18 when the first Twilight movie came out, and that was her jam. It does make me think. One of the things I was thinking about was that all the stuff we're kind of dealing with now, with it, like the Gamergate, Comicgate, the people who were like forced Kelly Marie Tran and Daisy Ridley off social media because, you know, Star Wars. I wonder if all that can be traced back to the backlash about Twilight, because I remember, I think it was 2009. They had a big Hall H Comic-Con panel with Twilight, and people were pissed off that, you know, all these twihards were besmirching Comic-Con with their presence. And it's like, you know, I thought fandom was fandom. And it's like, you know, Twilight may not be your cup of tea, but it's somebody's cup of tea. And they have every right to enjoy it and express themselves as anybody else.
They do. And maybe you need to watch the movie or read the books, because I hadn't. So probably in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, that's some teen fad or whatever. And watching the movie, I was into it for the first 20 minutes. So if I go from
there... got your hooks.
it got me hooked, so...
The first movie is interesting because it's Catherine Hardwicke, and she brings a little more sort of grittiness and a little more groundedness to it, which is something I think gets lost in the latter movies where they bring in sort of bigger directors. Mm-hmm. But she brings that very much that Lord of Dogtown and 13 mentality to it, which is something that it kind of really needs, because it's very much a flight of fancy and very romantic and old-fashioned romantic at that. So I would be interested to hear what you think of the entire movie, because it's
the start, definitely, like you're saying, grounded in the small town.
And, and I like Billy Burke as her dad in that. He's like the sheriff or the chief of police. I thought that was sadly some of his best work, but I digress. That brings us to Tim's favorite scary movies. We're going to do a top five.
Top five. All right.
As we did with Vince and Peter the last 2 weeks. We'll see if there's any crossover. We haven't had any crossover yet.
No.
But we're running out of the high class stuff. So we'll see what Tim thinks.
Okay.
And we'll start with your number five.
Okay. So when putting together this list, scary movies, I was thinking about like what did I watch during Halloween. They tend to be non-scary. So I watched like... American Werewolf in London, which is fun, a little bit scary. I watch like Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that kind of stuff, the campy stuff. But when it comes to scary movies, my number five is The Shining.
Oh, yes. Right.
Stanley Kubrick, 1980. As a Canadian, I can relate to being snowbound. And the feelings of isolation, which will be coming to all of us in a few short weeks.
Some of us, like, depending on where you live right now.
And just the imagery in it is just so intense, and like the blood spouting from the elevator, the twin girls, Even when the sun's just like biking down the corridor and is like three wheeler, it's so ominous.
Yeah,
and that sense of dread and Jack Torrance is the lead character there. Jack Nicholson, you know, the performance does go over the top, because I prefer Jack Nicholson in the early 70s. I thought he was best film actor ever in those films he did in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this one's a bit over the top. Stanley Kubrick was known for like long takes. Or multiple takes, you know, 40, 50, but...
On a good day.
Yeah, on a good day. But just his performance, and as this aspiring writer, and you can just see, because I write too, so there's a solitude with that. And if you're not getting anything done, it can make you a little bit stir crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just a terrific movie. I just thought, if you haven't seen it, see it. You may know some of the, here's Johnny and some of the... lines from it, but it really holds up well. And I would say just like the cinematography and the environment in Colorado and the Overlook Hotel with the snow and just the huge garden maze and a lot of the supporting characters as well. Scatman Crothers
is
the other one who has The Shining.
Yeah.
And their son Danny, who also has the telepathic abilities. It's really cool. And a similarity between pretty much all the films I chose is the ones that frighten me or tend to be psychological horror movies with some supernatural elements. Mm-hmm. And this one's right there near the top of my list at number five. I haven't read the book. I hear it's really good. I hear that Stephen King hated the adaptation.
Hates the movie.
But Stanley Kubrick would do his own thing.
Yeah.
And with Diane Johnson, I believe he wrote, who's a great like horror writer.
Yeah.
They did their own thing, and it.
And after you're done watching The Shining, watch the documentary Room 237, which posits all the various conspiracy theories about what the film means, which is fascinating in its own right.
Yeah. I've actually seen a documentary when they were filming it by Kubrick's daughter, and it's wild. It's not good from like a...
the documentary isn't good or what no, was going on behind the scenes
wasn't good?
The documentary
is good. It's not nice from a human resources standpoint on the film, the way Kubrick treats Shelley Duvall and Scatman Crothers.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jack Nicholson's just high on cocaine the whole time.
I believe
it. Yeah, just losing his mind. But it's really... Yeah, so that's number five on mine, The Shining.
So number four.
Number four. I'm old school, and a lot of my choices. Number four, Rosemary's Baby.
Ah, yes.
By Roman Polanski, 1968. And I'd highly recommend it to anyone who's into a good scare, good psychological horror once again. It's a pregnant woman who's... It's one of those films. Is it in her mind or is it actually happening? Mm-hmm, and she believes this cult is out to get her unborn baby and to use it for rituals. And very similar to The Shining, her husband, Guy Woodhouse, whereas Jack Torrance in The Shining is an aspiring actor, Guy Woodhouse, he wants to be a movie star, a TV star.
Yeah, yeah.
He's an actor, and he wants to get his big break. So that only increases the tension for Rosemary, played by Mia Farrow, who's thinking, okay, my husband, would he like sell me out to the devil
to be famous?
And Guy Woodhouse, played by John Cassavetes, who excellent director, but great performance by him as well. And what's really disturbing too are the character actors in this film, because they are so creepy. His neighbors, played by Ruth Gordon and Sydney Blackmer, just total creepy. So you can tell something's up, but they're so friendly. But they smile, yet you know there's something behind that smile. And what are they up to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think a movie like this was a big inspiration on a lot of horror movies. I think of a movie like Get Out.
Yeah.
Where...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, you're trapped in a situation. You're thinking, is it all in my head or are these people really, like, out to get me?
It's a good comparison, yeah.
And also a common trope of a lot of these is you have a friend who's outside, the last rational man in your universe.
Yeah.
And that's true. They have a friend named Hutch, or at least Mia Farrow does, Rosemary, who she can reach out to. And unlike Get Out, where they're doing research on the internet, okay, what happened to our missing friend on Google?
Yeah, yeah.
This 68, so they go to the library, they find books about witches to find out.
To the card catalog.
Yeah. They use the Dewey Decimal System to find out.
Oh, man. That takes you back.
Yeah, that's number four. Number three on my list is The Vanishing.
Ah.
The Dutch name Spoorloos, which look for the Dutch with the English subtitles, because it was remade in the early 90s with Kiefer Sutherland and Jeff Bridges and Sandra Bullock. I haven't seen the remake, but apparently they changed the ending.
Mm.
And the ending is one of the best endings in movie history, as far as I'm concerned, from what I've seen. And The Vanishing is just creepy. It's about a young couple. They go to sort of like a exit. Like they're on vacation. They go to like a... just sort of like a truck stop exit sort of place, and then she goes missing. She goes off to buy some stuff, and she goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows the sociopath who took her, and it shows it early in the film. So it's not like it's a mystery of like how did she get kidnapped. It's just looking into the mind of this crazy sociopath, and how he's so meticulous in how he's planning to kidnap somebody. It's an amazing film. It is scary as hell. And I would highly recommend it. But see the Dutch one with English subtitles for sure.
Yep.
That's
always sound advice for just about anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, number two.
Number two is Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock, 1960. I saw it and knew a little bit about it. Like everyone knows about the shower scene, even if you haven't seen the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's crazy how scary it is. Like 58 years later, it's still very scary. And there's a lot of unexpected moments. So we all know about the shower scene. It's very frightening. But there are other scenes, like the scene that always frightens me the most is when the private investigator is going up the stairs to find out what's going on in the house. And you don't see it coming, right? You think he's going to find the mother or talk to the mother, and you don't see what's about to happen. It's just out of the blue.
Yeah.
So I found that's just a very frightening movie. And the use of score as well in that by Bernard Herrmann, just excellent to create that mood. Something that John Carpenter did in Halloween, and great scary movies tend to do that. Really simple score that just frightens you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say Psycho definitely is one to watch. And there's a great scene actually in it where you identify with the villain, with Anthony Perkins.
Yeah.
Where he's trying to get rid of the body of Marion Crane. And he's put her in the trunk of a car, which he's trying to sink into the swamp out back of the motel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you realize that you're starting to identify with the psychopath when, as the car sinking into the swamp, it stops.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see he's all nervous, like, oh, no, I'm going to get caught.
Yeah.
And you as a viewer, like, oh, no, he's going to get caught.
His plan's coming apart.
It's just for that brief moment you identify.
Yeah,
you identify with the psychopath, and then luckily for him, it goes down.
Yeah, yeah,
and sinks to the bottom.
And you mentioned Carpenter too. It's easy to draw that line from Psycho to Halloween, because there's even a character called Loomis in Halloween, and Marion Crane's lover is I think it's Sam Loomis. So I think the name carries over to Halloween, where the hero psychiatrist is also Sam Loomis.
It just shows the influence of Hitchcock, too, right, on pretty much everything.
Yep. That brings us to number one.
Okay, number one. So I, like I said, I didn't go with your average ghoul movies, which I like a lot of ghoul movies, but with number one, I went, like, scary movies. For me, Blue Velvet.
Oh, wow.
Directed by David Lynch. It definitely doesn't fit neatly into the category of scary movies. But as far as psychological horror goes, I think it's a very, very frightening movie. And the villain in it, Frank Booth, is just one of the most terrifying villains I've seen in a movie before. There's such menace, too, in the way David Lynch directed it. And I think appeals to me in a way because I'm from a small town or small city. I'm from Stratford, Ontario, a nice picturesque city, right?
Yep.
And that's what David Lynch does. He has Jeffrey Beaumont, the lead character, Cal McLaughlin's from this picturesque town, this logging town. And it's like a Norman Rockwell painting where he's from. Big lawn, suburbs.
Yeah, yeah.
But in even the small city, there's the wrong side of the tracks.
Yep.
Which is the urban, more urban, like apartment building complex.
Yeah.
And what goes on there? What's hidden beneath the surface, which is what David Lynch said he was going for. What's hidden in these environments? And the scenes in the apartment where Jeffrey's hiding in the closet, just they're so claustrophobic, and where he's a voyeur to what's happening with Frank Booth and Isabella Rossellini.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very terrifying. So from a psychological horror standpoint, that's definitely number one for me. And
it's a great example of David Lynch, who's always like, his movies are like, everything's fine. This is a nice place. This is a nice couple. And then some weirdo comes in and screws it all up.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, there's like humor in it. It's really off the wall. Some people have even called it a comedy, but there's like parts of it that are just really terrifying. And I think it really weighs with you from a standpoint that as weird as it is, it could happen. You know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. There could be a character like Frank Booth who's just psychotic and just kidnapping people and driving around with his merry band of crazy people who sing Roy Orbison's or lip sync Roy Orbison songs and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a way to ruin Roy Orbison, David yeah. Lynch. Anyway, that's Tim's list. We're 15 for 15. We haven't had any repeats yet.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, so that's not bad. We'll see what happens next week with Candace. But the ground is getting thinner for the really good ones, I think. But we'll see what Candace comes up with next week. So we're going to move on to our review of Bad Times at the El Royale. And we're going to cue that up with a little Baby Cages from their album Bitter Melon. And that's number one on the CFRU chart right now. So we're going to play some Baby Cages, and then we're going to come back with our review. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Lady's got a hotter hand than we do, Father.
I am very sorry to keep you waiting.
Damn, boy, where you been? Waiting in this lobby so long, I could use a shave. What's wrong with you?
I'm very sorry. What are you doing here, Father?
Do I know you, son?
No, but I mean, this is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
We might need to work on your sales pitch, son. The El Royale, no place for a priest.
There are other hotels, Father. Maybe closer to Tahoe, I could help you find one. I'm sure you would be happier there.
Miles, is it? If this is not a place for a priest, Miles, then this is exactly where the Lord wants me.
Famous last words from Father Jeff Bridges. And that is a clip from Bad Times at the El Royale. It is the new film from Drew Goddard, and it stars Jeff Bridges, Cynthia Erivo, Dakota Johnson, John Hamm, Kaylee Spani, Lewis Pullman, and Chris Hemsworth. So Drew Goddard is a name people may not be familiar with. They may probably more familiar with his work. He wrote Cloverfield, the very first Cloverfield movie. He wrote The Martian, which was the Golden Globe-winning comedy a few years back, directed by Ridley Scott. In terms of his own work, he directed Cabin in the Woods, which I remember as one of those movies that I didn't know anything about until I saw it. Like, I don't think I'd even seen a trailer for it until I saw it. And it's one of those movies where you are grateful to have not seen the trailer. But it's also one of those movies where you say to someone, or you're talking to someone, and someone says, have you seen any movies? And you say, oh, yes, I saw Cabin in the Woods. What's it about? I really can't tell you, because then I start spoiling the movie. Fortunately, Bad Times at the El Royale isn't quite like that. But, I mean, I would say that it's not impossible this conversation may drift into spoilers, because it's very much akin to that. It's not a movie you can really fully discuss without drifting a bit into spoilers. So I'll just I'll put that warning out there for people. Did you see Cabin in the Woods by chance?
No.
No? You should.
Yeah, I heard it's good. Yeah.
Did you like Bad Times at the El Royale, though?
Wasn't a huge fan of it.
Really?
Yeah. It's weird, yeah. I don't know. I saw really good reviews for it. Person I went to really liked it. I wasn't that big a fan, because I don't know, it seemed a bit like a bit contrived to me, a bit like Tarantino light sort of thing. And I actually usually like slow paced movies, but even at the beginning I just found it really slow. Two things I really liked about it were, like, the surprise violence. There's some really good shock violence that makes you jump in your seat,
because
you don't see it coming at right that moment. And then the singing of Cynthia Erivo.
Yeah.
Cynthia Erivo, I think she should be considered the star of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because she was terrific, and her singing was awesome. Her acting was good, too. But I found, like, a lot of the characters, they were sort of, like, I don't know, just sort of one-dimensional in a way. And some of the accents, I know, like, John Hamm's doing, like, a fake accent because I guess he's an FBI agent at the start, but I just found it a little bit annoying.
He's undercover.
Yeah, so he's doing that fake, I'm a vacuum cleaner salesman, and then Jeff Bridges, I'm a priest, and it's pretty obvious he isn't right off the beginning. I think it'd be more interesting if maybe he was, or it wasn't so obvious.
Right.
I thought there were a lot of...
Well, I mean, that's something that's spoiled in the trailer, too, that, you know, the scene where he and the character that Cynthia Erivo plays, but they're sitting in the car, and he tells her that he's not a priest. That's spoiled in the trailer, unfortunately. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that set up, like, not everyone here is not what they seem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, a movie I really liked that was like that was The Hateful Eight, where they're all trapped, and, of course, that's Tarantino. I don't want to say just because this isn't Tarantino, it's not a good movie, although I don't think it was, but it had its moments for me. But I just think it could have been so much more. And I think it's missing sort of some humor in it as well.
I thought,
and it really goes off in this, what I felt like a bit of a tangent about like cults and religion and trying to make a point about it, I suppose, trying to get deep when... It could have been a lot more fun and funny, and I think would have held together better as a movie if it was that way.
I almost think that's the point, though, that there really is no, like, there's nothing too deep with the cult or with Billy Lee, the leader of the cult, like, his own, like, maybe there is no God, maybe there is, but I'm going to have you guys fight because why not? It's, you know, I think the fact that his philosophy is, like, toes deep. Is kind of the point, but I understand what you're saying. I think I found this quote online. I'm a huge fan of Agatha Christie style mysteries, Tarantino movies, 60s music, and Chris Hemsworth's body. So obviously, I love this movie, and I think I think that's a pretty good assessment of sort of where you are. The Tarantino inspiration is obvious. But I think that when Pulp Fiction came out, there were a ton of like Tarantino-esque things. That's where the origin of Tarantino-esque came in. Yeah. But I think this goes sort of a step above that because there is kind of that Agatha Christie kind of angle where we're going to get a bunch of strangers together and each one of them is going to have like a little mystery. And we have to kind of figure out what the gag is here and what's really going on. And yeah, I love the sudden bursts of violence. it's like some of the scenes are so well staged too. There's the scene where John Hamm discovers the secret viewing hallway into all the rooms and the sound design there, the score, and then the score fades out when he turns on one of the speakers and it's Cynthia Erivo singing the Isley Brothers, and it the way it echoes down that hallway and as he's kind of like coming to terms with the secrets of the hotel, it's so amazingly well realized. And then there's another scene later on, again featuring Cynthia Erivo singing, where one of the other characters finds the hallway and is looking in her room as she's singing, but also as the Jeff Bridges character is delicately searching the room for what he's come there for while they're being observed by one of the other guests, by the Dakota Johnson character. And they're trying to make sure that they don't tip her off. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, like, it's all out there that everyone here has a secret agenda, so they're trying to go under the radar. But there was such the tension in that scene was wonderful as she was like clapping as he was like using a hammer and trying to play it cool and not get noticed by the girl with the big shotgun.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there were scenes like that I thought that put this a touch above in terms of the filmmaking ability against your average Tarantino kind of copycat, because I think a lot of people after Pulp Fiction thought we get a bunch of like bad characters together and they talk cool and we throw in some pop culture references. That's basically what Tarantino does. Mm-hmm. Well, it actually there's actually more to it than that, and I think there's more to it than with El Royale, at least how Goddard's made it.
Yeah, I thought it was really, like you're saying, well staged, great cinematography.
Yeah,
great sound design,
mm-hmm.
and the singing is amazing, like we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like it kind of fell flat a bit. And one choice I might have made differently would have been having the John Hamm character, the FBI agent, be involved later in the movie.
Mm.
I think if there was, because you get to this point where there's a bunch of anti-heroes, and it kind of gets diluted because they're all anti-heroes, to me anyway. If there was somebody, you know, somebody from the law there, like, investigating, it could have added a little more substance to it, I guess. Otherwise, I don't know, like, even with the roulette, which was cool. Like, I really like the hotel. I really love California and Vegas. I've been, or Nevada, right? And I've been to Vegas a few times. I love the idea, too, of the hotel.
On the border. Yeah,
and I thought something could have been done with that more later on as well. Mm-hmm. It was cool in the beginning. And I really liked, who's the gentleman who played the guy who works at the hotel?
That's Lewis Pullman.
I really liked him.
Yeah, he's a great find.
I thought he was really, really good. A young kid who's really distressed from his past, and shooting heroin in the back so he can't hear when people are coming into the hotel.
Yeah.
And he's the one spying in the hotel rooms, reporting back to his bosses.
Management.
Nondescript management. But... yeah, and he introduces it to each guest as they check in. Okay, you want to be on the California side?
Yeah.
Or the, you know, the California side, the where Nevada movie stars side. Or the Nevada, where you know, gamble and stuff.
Yeah.
But I thought something could have been done with that later on where, I don't know, where somebody's, like, crossing state lines or something, or law enforcement's coming. I just thought they could have had more fun with that. Because it's kind of just hangs there. It's sort of this you know, it's just this, you know, this motif that's brought on at the start of the film, and it just sort of hangs there, and they don't really use it anymore after that, right?
Yeah, there may have been some symbolism that isn't what laid out that well in terms of why it's a thing on the other than the kitsch value, because I think that's kind of a very 60s kitsch thing. It's like, mm-hmm. you can stay in California or you can stay in Nevada because we're right on the state line.
Yeah.
But it does make for the hotel itself to be like this fascinating character. Every room sort of has a different in terms of like decoration, a little bit different, and the main lobby where much of the action takes place is such a great design. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the real, maybe a bit too far to say it's the real star of it, but I mean that's in terms of like laying the stage, in terms of setting the stage, because we spend a lot of time in that lobby first thing as everybody's checking in.
Mm-hmm.
That it is somewhat interesting to think back now and say, well, the hotel kind of wasn't really that much of a character, even though it's kind of well established as a character. It's sort of like this kind of haunted mm-hmm. mansion kind of mm-hmm. vibe that maybe could have been utilized a bit better. But I think it's more to the point that it's sort of setting it up as a playground for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think I want to say too, speaking of people behind the scenes, Michael Giacchino's score, I liked a lot. I think mm-hmm. he was on his game there. I think I found him hit or miss lately, and this is definitely a hit. But it's the film itself. I think the, not to dismiss your points, but I do think that maybe that playing with the tropes and being sort of very explicitly sort of one dimensional, like this character is the cult leader, this character is the cult follower, this character is the police officer, this character is the priest with a dark past, and it's very much what Drew Goddard did with Cabin in the Woods, where you have the five young people going into the woods, and you had the jock, and you had the mm-hmm. slut, and you had the stoner and the good girl, and on and on and on. And what was fascinating was how those things become subverted through the course of the film, or how characters either fall into their traps or they overcome the traps they're supposed to fall in. And I think that's maybe something that was missed here, is that maybe people fall into their traps a bit too easily in some cases. But I will say the Lewis Pullman character, the what was his name?
Miles.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the more interesting touches, because clearly this kid is messed up, but you never find out why until mm-hmm. the very, very, very late end.
Yeah.
But he does a really good job of sort of playing two sort of sides of Miles against each other. And one is this side that, you know, he talks to Jeff Bridges like Jeff Bridges is a priest, and he's like desperately looking for absolution. Mm-hmm. So he's this good kid that's been, you know, sort of, I don't know, squeezed out of any mm-hmm. bit of morality, which is why he's doing the heroin. And that becomes very clear over the course of the film. And it's one of the more subtler bits in the film, is just how messed up this character is and why he's messed up. And it's interesting to sort of watch what happens to him by the end, that mm-hmm. It's almost like he's kind of the hero of the story, even though he's introduced as this like meek sort of mealy mm-hmm. I work at this hotel I guess because there's nowhere else in the world I can be, but yeah, it's I think there's some subtle nuance here, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, probably. I think a lot polishes it up with the score and the singing, and mm-hmm. which is the same true of a lot of movies, right? Once you put all the layers in, all the technical layers, it makes the movie better. And in this case, it definitely does.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if you peel those away, though, it's kind of, I don't know, it just felt to me almost like weird in a way. He was just trying to throw everything out there, right? Like, kudos to him trying to throw all this stuff out there. But does it coalesce into a, you know, I don't need a statement on my movies, but maybe I do. Does it coalesce into a statement or some sort of point of view at the end? Or is it just basically, I'm going to put these eccentric characters in the shady hotel and just, like, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
I'll give it that. Although I did find it very slow at the beginning, but it was entertaining. But does it really lead to, you know, lead to anything? It feels like he's trying to make a statement too, right?
Mm.
Like, maybe he's not. Maybe he's like, I'm just going to make this cult leader one-dimensional. Or maybe he was trying to say something about cults and brainwashing and, you know, and especially in the 60s with Charles Manson and stuff. Maybe he's trying to make a point about that. But it just kind of...
Yeah.
It just kind of spun out for me. It just kind of spun out and kind of fell flat as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder if it's kind of like it's not really made explicit, because there's in the background there's this news story on the TV about a couple that's been stabbed. So your mind automatically goes to like, oh, he's kind of like a Manson-ish kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's ever made explicitly clear that the murder on the TV is the same murder we see in some of the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sort of convinced that maybe there are different murders that you're meant to draw a conclusion.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about what's on the TV. Yeah. I was thinking about his control over the young girl. Because that's pretty much Manson had
these
young girls who he controlled, do what I say now, and they did it kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's what I, with the young girl who's quite freaky, so I'll give her that. Kaylee Spaney, who plays Rose Summerspring, who, you know, goes against her own sister just basically because she's fallen under the allure of this cult leader, right? And okay, I'm gonna do what you say now.
Yeah, it's interesting because of course Tarantino's working on a Manson movie.
Yeah,
one wonders how that will look perhaps in sort of this Tarantino inspired film, you know, and sort of has tackled it first. And Manson himself is, of course, like a freaky figure that I don't think has been sort of dealt with sort of straight up in a mainstream movie in a while. Because, yeah, I mean, his control over people, like Squeaky Frome was like still trying to kill Ford on his order, like years after he went to jail, which is,
yeah,
it's incredible. Maybe there might be some renewed interest because he just died earlier this year. But anyway, yeah, you didn't like seeing Thor, though, as a cult leader? Because, I mean, that was one of the things.
Great abs.
Oh, man, those abs. You can grate cheese on those abs, man. But it's interesting because it's a direction Chris Hemsworth hasn't done before, which is, like, both villainous but also, like, sort of, like, grossly unlikable.
Yeah. He was having fun with it. It was
for sure.
Of like this villainous Jim Morrison Jesus. Jim Morrison Jesus, but, yeah, Charles Manson, but way better looking, I guess, is what he was going for. But yeah, he swaggers in. He's definitely having fun with it. And I think that's what the whole cast is probably having fun with it, you know.
They're swagger,
they're
man.
They're trying all, because people like to be villainous, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's fun to be bad, so.
It's good to be bad, yeah.
So he came in, and if, I guess for the abs alone, but you can probably see those in the trailer. I've seen that a lot in the trailer, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to see his abs, you can go, like, to any one of the Thor movies.
Yeah.
There are shirtless scenes. Or any Chris Hemsworth movie, for that matter. I can't really think of one where a Chris Hemsworth movie where there was
no shirtless scene. It's in his contract, then,
it's,
right?
Yeah, he doesn't do all that working out for himself, clearly. It's just, I did find him a bit more interesting because I think it was because it was that empty vessel. You know, mm-hmm. It's like he's trying to, like, sort of puff himself up. He knows he's kind of a nobody, but he knows he's pretty and he can have this allure and he can mm-hmm. make girls fight over him. And it was also just an interesting direction for Chris Hemsworth because, I mean, he's played sort of unlikable guys. It's, you know, I'm thinking of, like, Rush, for example, where he was playing a real life Formula One driver, but it was kind of a prick. But in here, he was like just completely oily and gross. And you know, the scene where he's like getting the girls to fight each other, and he's like, "Oh, the winner will get to spend the evening in my home,
in the big house,
in the big house." That's right. And it's just like, ew. It's, you know, that's so gross. But I did like. The reason why I think it's sort of played to the emptiness is that scene with where he's talking to the Cynthia Erivo character, and you know, he's talking to her and he's got this film that everyone is after, this film strip. And he's like, "Oh, but you'll like to see who's on this," and she's like, "It doesn't even matter because it's just another, you know, man who thinks he's powerful and really has nothing to say, or man who talks." I can't remember her exact line, but it's man who talks so much he thinks he believes in something, but deep down he believes in nothing.
Right.
And the Billy Lee, the cult leader, he tries to respond to that, and she's like, "No, you've got nothing," and shuts him down.
Yeah.
And that was such a great little scene.
Yeah.
So, I guess, long story short, I like the movie, but I think we agree that there's more here than just, you know, some Tarantino ripoff.
Yeah, and Drew Goddard, he's very talented from this movie. Like, you can tell, like, he has some great movies in him, and I'd like to see Cabin in the Woods. I've heard good things about it, so I'll go back and watch that.
Cabin in the Woods is well worth checking out because I think what he's trying to do here, he realizes better in Cabin in the Woods.
Right.
Because I think because it's more maybe, and also because he had Joss Whedon's help on the script on that one. So maybe Whedon's ideas were able to maybe flesh out his ideas a bit better, whereas he wrote the screenplay for this one by himself. I don't know. I would love to see it again, to see, now that I know where it goes, and to see if maybe it holds up on a second viewing.
Yeah, I should check it out. Yeah, he's talented, it's entertaining, but we'll see. I'm interested to see what he does next.
Good enough. All right, that was Bad Times at the El Royale. I keep on saying Battle at the El Royale because of Battle Royale, but
that's a better name. Yeah,
Yeah, it is a better name. Write it down. Bad Times at the El Royale. If you like this episode of End Credits, you'll be able to hear it again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Tim, if people want to find you on the internet.
On the interwebs. Check me out.
Not the card catalogs, the internet.
I'm more old school. I like the card catalogs. Find me in the Dewey Decimal System. But I like Flash in the Deadpan on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or myself. If you want to reach out, you want to find Tim Phillips. Hard to search for Tim Phillips, though, such a common name. But check out Flash in the Deadpan.
All right, you can find that on the internet. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.ca. And, of course, I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. Actually, no, correction, 4 p.m. because we're doing back-to-back open sources tomorrow. So 4 p.m. is more council interviews. 5 p.m. is mayor interviews with incumbent Mayor Cam Guthrie. So tune in to CFRU tomorrow for that. And stay tuned to CFRU right now for more great programming. CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits. And we'll see you then.